This episode of the Coin Spice Podcast is brought to you by Cash Shuffle, because what you do with your money is your business. To give this new product a try for fungibility and privacy, head on over to electroncash.org, download their latest wallet 4.0.0, and give it a spin. CashShuffle.com for more information, because what you do with your money is your business.
What is really going on, crypto savages? You are listening to the Coin Spice Podcast with host C. Edward Kelso, editor-in-chief at coinspice.io, your home for spicy crypto things on the net.
Let's get into it then. I have, of course, Vinny Lingham, who probably needs no introduction to most of my listeners, investor, business owner, entrepreneur, more recently with Civic, but he goes back to Gift and way before then. He's known, of course, in the space as the Bitcoin Oracle, which he usually smirks at. And anyway, we're just it's an honor, really, to have you on the show. So thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Ed. Great to be on the show.
All right, so let's do this then. I think probably the topic that people would love to hear you wax about, at least immediately, would be Bitfinex and Tether. And I didn't really know, I guess I should have, but I didn't really know how you were going to come down on it. I'm not a huge fan of speculation and that particular exchange in general, but I thought maybe you'd be a little bit more positive towards Tether, and it turns out I was completely wrong, right?
Yeah, why would I be positive towards Tether? I mean, look, I've been tweeting out since 2017 about this topic. I mean, ever since Bitfinex got hacked, and they issued the tokens, and then the tokens mysteriously got converted into Tether. Tether mysteriously changed their reserves from USD to crypto assets or whatever it was. You know, I've been suspicious, and I've been tweeting a lot about it, and I've gotten a lot of grief over the years about it, and, you know, retweeting Bitfinex and et cetera. You know, I just don't believe it was a clean operation. I don't believe that there's enough records and audit trails going back to show what actually happened. And, you know, I just don't think that as a crypto community where, you know, the whole thing's about transparency and proof of reserves and, you know, own your own coins, that, like, I don't know how we are happy with these centralized exchanges that don't show that they have what they claim they have. And it's really easy for anyone to render an amount on a balance on a screen on, you know, on your account, but it doesn't mean that the funds are there.
Right. So, and are you necessarily against the stable coin idea and pegging something like
that? No. I love the stable coin idea. I think like Gemini dollars and USDC, like these are fantastic. These are regulated entities, US dollars in the bank. I think that the opportunity for stable coins is massive globally in terms of how you can create digital money at a fixed currency peg. Now, Bitcoin is something different, right? So the Bitcoin is effectively a different unit of account. And at the right levels of scale, Bitcoin, the vision for Bitcoin was that this unit of account becomes, you know, what we use as you know, medium of exchange and store of value and transactional currency, but it would take years to get there. Obviously, with the bifurcation and trifurcation of the Bitcoin communities, and I say tri because I don't really think there's more than three major communities out there, you know, if that. You know, we've basically got a splitting of opinions and views, and Bitcoin has gone from being a unified force to being divided. And, you know, you got the Bitcoin Cash, Bitcoin SV, BTC people, and quite frankly, I'm at the point where I don't agree with any of the camps right now in terms of the way things are being done and how things are done. And it doesn't mean to say that there won't be good investments for the long term, and some of them may, you know, one of them may wind up working really big, and Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin could get to $1 million a coin, absolutely. Like, if there's enough people with a shared delusion on money, that these things can happen. So I'm not against it from that perspective. I just think the utility has been compromised in terms of what we were trying to do as OGs back in the day and create the digital money for the web, which was easy to use and you know, and it would appreciate the more people use it, etc. So it was both an investment and a utility, and I think we've wound up splitting it out, and it either has to be one or the other. And the evolution and path of this stuff seems suspect to me. So having said that, stable coins for me present a different type of opportunity to solve the payment industry problems that exist today because you can actually have digital dollars on the web with no transaction fees or very low transaction fees, which would undermine Visa, MasterCard, etc., and would be backed by real dollars in a bank account. So, you know, then the argument would be from some people, well, what are those dollars worth?
Okay, right.
It doesn't matter, right? Until the US dollar goes to zero, which it hasn't and may not, and I'm not a big fan of MMT either, modern monetary theory, but, you know, these things perpetuate over time. So it's very hard to get everyone in the world on the same page. So you always have these sort of different pockets of tension competing. It doesn't, like, nothing ever goes to zero, not even in BitConnect. You went to zero for a long time, right? So I think it's more about exploration to see what happens and running experiments and seeing what sticks. And so I think when it comes to digital cash, I think that stable coins present a better opportunity for digital cash in the short to medium term, purely because the ideologies behind Bitcoin and crypto are somewhat suspect in the short term, given the scaling limitations, the community, the communities and the way they view this as, you know, a get rich quick scheme, et cetera, et cetera.
You talk about all over the world how the US dollar is more valuable outside than it is inside. And I think that is a valuable insight. I don't know why it took me so long to figure this out, but you're actually from South Africa, right?
Yeah, I'm originally from South Africa. I moved to the States about 11 years ago. I'm now a dual citizen. So my family's of Indian origin. So I'm an Indian African American.
I was going to tease you about that. I was going to call you an African American. So what the heck was it like? I mean, you know, my frame of reference for South Africa, you know, remember, I'm an American, so we don't have to know anything about the world. So my frame of reference is, you know, there was this guy named Stephen Biko, then there was Mandela, and, you know, now Dave Chappelle went there to recover. I mean, that's pretty much my general overview. So how was it being an Indian kid growing up in apartheid South Africa?
Well, for all intents and purposes, I was considered black, so I couldn't do, right. I was with, you know, so you had Indian areas, colored areas, black areas. You had to live in one of those three, but it meant the same. There was curfews. You couldn't go out after like 7 o'clock at night. And I grew up with this until the age of probably about, I think it was about 9. So apartheid really ended, apartheid ended when I was 12. But up until the age of like 9 or 10, it was pretty bad, and then it kind of started easing out, and then apartheid officially ended when I was 12. So I definitely have vivid memories of it. I never understood why the system was in place. It was very, very weird. It was like, you know, you're Indian, so this is the way it is. Like, okay, you know, you as a child, you kind of become accepting of the circumstances. The one very interesting, point was, though, I spent a lot of time in the public library because I wasn't allowed to go anywhere else. I couldn't go to you couldn't go to the beaches, you couldn't go to the pools, you couldn't use any amenities. It was literally like whites only written everywhere. And this is like in the 80s, right? So this is kind of, it wasn't that long ago, and this is how South Africa was. And so, you know, I think I spent a lot of time in the library. I got into computers and programming, and I managed to get a computer. My dad got me a small little ZX Spectrum, and I started, you know, getting all the library books. I started writing code at like the age of like 8 or 9 because I had nothing else to do with my time, literally, because I couldn't do anything else. So I was a total geek as a kid. So I went from ZX Spectrum to Commodore 64, then XTs, 80s, 386s, 486s, Pentiums, the whole lot. And I built computers and I did programming, and I eventually studied programming at the University of Cape Town. And by the time I got there, I was the best programmer in my class for years at university. So I have a good, strong technical background as a kid because of apartheid, because otherwise I would have been enjoying my life a lot more, I guess, at least growing up. But, you know, obviously,
that's crazy.
Imagine the public library was my only place of solace, like the only place I could go to.
It's your refuge, yeah.
Yeah, but my refuge. Like on a Saturday, my dad would drop me off at like 8 a.m. and pick me up at 4 o'clock, and I spent the whole day reading in the library and just going through tons of books. So I would have a decent general knowledge on this stuff. And then it kind of led me to my next venture. My current venture was a civic, because when I look back at growing up in apartheid South Africa, one of the biggest issues is democracy in the world, right? How do you solve democracy? And you do it through, I believe, enabling voting. People don't appreciate that democracy doesn't scale in the analog world, because the cost to vote is disproportionately reduced. The value to vote is disproportionately reduced over time relative to the cost. So if I'm one of 100 people voting in a country election, you know, my vote's 1%, right? So that would be like pretty worth my time to spend 10 hours or 20 hours, even like a week voting. But if I'm one out of 300 million, like if you're asking me to spend 5 hours to go vote, is my vote really worth 5 hours to the country? No. But if you said, look, it's 30 seconds on your phone, more people would vote. And I think what we're seeing the byproduct of democracy in the world is that if the cost to vote exceeds the value to vote, people will vote less. And in countries with low democratic turnouts, you have presidents who are elected which don't represent the population belief, because a lot of the people who are just too busy to vote can't vote, and then you have outcomes which are undesirable. In South Africa, a good example is people have to give up a day's worth of work and income, and these people are living hand to mouth, so to speak, to go stand 8 hours in a line to go vote because they have to be there in person. They've got to travel to a voting station, and they've got to so it's just kind of nuts. So when we started Civic, that was
I was going to say. So your kind of answer to this, or an answer, a way to facilitate what you're talking about, is to kind of mitigate that ratio, is through Civic, right? In that project.
Yeah. So that's how we started the company. We believe that, and we still do long term, that that's the solution. But when we started talking to regulators and governments, identity is the biggest issue. No one trusts digital identity systems. No one trusts that your identity is on your device, or you can have a digital representation of your passport or your driver's license. So we said, okay, well, maybe in 10 years' time we solve voting, but right now, let's solve digital identity. Let's give people the ability to create cryptographic keys which represent their identity on their devices, enable privacy, security, don't store any data. So we don't have a central database that stores all your personal information. And we can give you a digital ID that you can use to assert your identity wherever you are. So it's kind of the viewpoint that, like, if you look at the world today, Experian, Equifax, TransUnion, governments, all your data is like siloed and housed there, and they get hacked, it all gets out. Where Civic is a decentralized version of that. So we give people the ability to use the data. And then we build products around that, like ID Code, Civic Pay. We're working with vending machine companies to do beer vending machines.
Got a lot of press. I remember that.
Yeah, and it still does. And it's an interesting angle. But all this is us finding use cases that digital identity works for, and seeing adoption cycles that make sense to us, where people can adopt digital IDs. Because we're not going to adopt digital IDs for voting off the bat. We're going to adopt it for day-to-day use cases first, and then voting becomes a byproduct. So it definitely is a longer-term vision we have for the company, where we want to go. But that's how we were founded. So a lot of where we are today is because of growing up in apartheid South Africa, I guess.
That is so nuts. And is, for, I think, people in the West, we understand, obviously, identification and losing your license or birth certificate or whatever. But the record keeping, at least, relatively speaking, seems to be, all right. Whereas in other parts of the world, I mean, you basically, you're non-existent, right? Without identification. I mean, access to really anything.
Yeah, but 2 billion people in the world don't have a form of identification.
Right.
So then you get into all the refugee crises, et cetera, around the world. This is where digital identity can really clean up this mess we're in worldwide. But it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take years. And so we have to just sit by, I guess, as technologists, and build the technologies and try and drive adoption, because it's not, unfortunately, governments do control what is used and what is regulated in identity systems.
Sure. And I was going to ask, is there any worry on your part that maybe, not only do they not want better ID systems, but, if the ultimate goal is more people voting, there's a side of me that says maybe they're not going to be so hot on that either.
That's exactly correct. I mean, that's a big issue that we faced in the beginning of the days of the companies chain to governments. And unfortunately, but both sides of the equation in the US, I think, is apprehensive about voting digitally. But in general, most countries, the low voter turnout is actually favored by the status quo, because they don't want change. And so it's really hard to get it passed. So this is why we don't think we founded the company with the long-term principles that that's what we'd like to solve. But in the short term, we just don't think it's realistic, because democracy is not something which is easily delivered, should I say.
Hey, Crypto Savages, this is C. Edward Kelso breaking in with a quick and very shameless plug. CoinSpice.io is a feisty pirate ship. We depend, rely on almost entirely organic growth, which means our audience really does the marketing for us, and there's nothing more powerful than word of mouth. If you read an article you like on CoinSpice.io, if you listen to a podcast and you enjoy the content, or if you're just pissed, please promote us on social media, wherever you're at, wherever that is, whether it's Reddit, whether it's YouTube, Telegram, you name it, Twitter, like us, retweet, all that great stuff. You can always find detailed show notes for every podcast on the corresponding page at coinspice.io. There you'll find links to our respective podcast, your favorite platform like iTunes. Please give us a rating. Please give us a subscribe. You know all that good stuff. It helps the pirate ship remain afloat. It keeps us going. We appreciate it. As always, you can contact me personally if you have questions, concerns, you want to hear from a particular guest, you have a news tip at Kelso, K-E-L-S as in Sam, O, at coinspice.io. Thanks again for listening. We sure do appreciate it. And back to the episode.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I've had some CEOs on, and I've had people talk to people in the business, in the crypto industry, blockchain industry generally, and I've never heard anybody this candid. So that is super, super refreshing to hear. And it definitely gives me a lot of confidence in the civic idea. On the identification thing, on the, being somebody in the world, as Jesse Jackson might've said years ago, you're a big deal, certainly in crypto. I mean, you're a star here, but you're kind of even a bigger deal in South Africa, right? You're part of the Shark Tank program there.
Yeah, so I happen to sit in Mark Cuban's seat on the left on screen, beamed into millions of homes in South Africa. So, the good news is when I'm down there, I think it's really good to connect with people there and give back to my country and do what I can. And so I also co-founded Silicon Cape, which is the tech hub, back in 2009. I've got a small VC private office fund called Newtown Partners in Cape Town, which I co-founded in 2014. My partner Luke Clausen runs there. We've done a bunch of crypto stuff, investments, and that firm manages all my investments in South Africa. Because day to day, I focus pretty much all my time on civics. So it's good to have teams of people who can get stuff done using my name, I guess. Because what happens is you go on the show, you spend 10 days filming. I make, 10 offers or 15 offers or whatever it is. And then I leave and I go back to California where I live.
Right.
And I have a team of like 12 people just take care of the mess that I create when I'm down doing Shark Tank.
It's one of my favorite shows in the United States version. I've watched pretty much every iteration. And I I'm going to be presumptuous here, but your experience being so different from even the people on the U.S. Shark Tank that I've watched. You've seen parts of the world and how people are treated in very, very, I don't want to cast aspersions on the U.S. Version, but I think you bring something just dramatically different. It's part of what drives you, at least, this idea that, there's sort of the traditional efforts of giving back and kind of charity, and rather seeing that, in my worldview anyway, that the real way to give back is to empower people through capital, through entrepreneurial activity. Does any of that drive you?
Yeah, I think what drives me, and this is, from my home being, original home being Africa, I think I see myself as, I'm a dual citizen now, so I see myself as, American and African. But in South Africa, what I do there is, I really believe that education is how we solve Africa's problems, and the cost of education is dropping rapidly around the world because of the internet, which is fantastic. So connectivity and services and helping people understand how to, create microeconomies where they can create businesses and support themselves and their families is critical there. I mean, I'll give you an example of two investments I've made in South Africa. So one is Databits, Augmentors. They were on Shark Tank. They were trying to figure out how to create digital scarcity, effectively, you know, NFTs, non-fungible tokens. And they had no idea about Bitcoin or anything. I did the first ever Bitcoin deal on a Shark Tank show. There's like 13 Shark Tank, 13 countries around the world that run Shark Tank. So this was the first deal ever done in Bitcoin on screen. And then we did a token offering for these guys in early 2017. And they're still going. They're still working on, you know, solving some of the game mechanics stuff. But this is a real team that we backed, and they're actually working hard to build a product, and they've got a token out there. So that was one of the first token offerings, actually. It was done in like January 2017. So there was some pioneering work that was done there. And before people even knew what it was, and they raised, I think it was like $1 million in BTC at that point, out of Cape Town. So I backed these guys. We've had a change up in the team because, unfortunately, as you know, as times change, we had to bring in a more professional CEO. But you know, the founders at least had the vision for what they wanted to build with the augmented game, and now we've got a new team that's really focusing on trying to build it. And you know, like all startups, is ups and downs, and this is an example of one where I think finding product market fit for a game is a lot harder than you know it may seem. And when I was initially on the show and making the investment, but you know you bring the right people in and you learn from it. And I think that the team is moving towards really trying. You know, we've got some really interesting IP there that they developed, and we'll see how it goes. But that's one way, you know, sometimes it's a bit of a, you're giving guys a chance, right? And you see what you can do. The other investment I made was in a company called SweepSouth. Now, I literally wrote the first check for these guys, myself and one of the other sharks, or it was actually on Dragon's Den, which is the sister program to Shark Tank. And right. we put in a small amount of money. I think it was like $35,000, which is about R500,000, which basically got them started. And I found them through, we were at a startup pitch event in 2014. They now employ 12,000 women in South Africa who are basically house cleaners that are on demand, and it's generating, you know, I don't know, some ridiculous amount of revenue, but it's creating jobs for 12,000 women who now feed their families because of this application. So talk about impact, right? With the $25,000 investment from me and $25,000 sitting from the other investors, like we put in enough cash to literally create 12,000 jobs in over 5 or 6 years. Well, that's where they're at, and they're still growing, right? So that's where they're at right now. And that's the impact of small amounts of money invested in Africa. You can change a lot. I can't even begin to imagine how many lives are affected because of the little investment I made. So the social impact, and by the way, I've done well financially on the investment as well. The company's growing massively, 50x type returns. Yeah.
That's the point a lot of people miss, I think, is that, you know, they think of it as just one-sided. Well, here's Vinny just doing the Lord's work, so to speak. And while some of that's, you know, true, and you have, you know, you want to help people, the other side is this, it has to make economic sense, right?
Absolutely. And so we made the investment, good valuation, and it's been a really good ride in being there with the founders and helping them. And again, it doesn't take up a lot of my time. I've got a team there. It's the money was one part, and I think I've given them two or three bits of advice along the way that's changed the trajectory of the business at the right points in time, and I helped them optimize margin, et cetera, et cetera. And that's it. So for like a small amount of time, small amount of money, I've changed the lives of 12,000 families, and that's something I'm proud of.
And I think you should be. And also through women, that seems to be, as far as everything I read, really the connection for any kind of future growth is to empower them economically to either give them jobs or to at least put them in charge of capital and
even more so, 12,000 largely black female entrepreneurs, and the company is run by a black female entrepreneur. But like, this is a minority group that's been disparaged in South Africa for a century, and now they're economically empowered to help their families and support their families, which is amazing, right? And you know, you think about like this sort of impact, how this changes the world generations down the line. Their kids can go to school, their kids can get fed, they, you know, you can end the poverty cycle. So these are the sorts of investments that really appeal to me, but it has to have the economic side of it as well. It can't, and it's always about the people, right? What's the founder, what's their mission? And so let's go back to like Bitcoin for a second. This is why I give you know, Samson Mao so much crap on Twitter, you know, because like his view is Bitcoin shouldn't be used by poor people, and Bitcoin is not for poor people and less than $2 a day. Like, that is ridiculous. If you've been to Africa, you'd know that is patently untrue. the fact that he can still go up there and say that, and it's ridiculous. And he'll probably try and change the narrative over time, but that's what he said, and that's what he tweeted out. That's what he believes. And for Bitcoin fees can't get to the point where it's prohibitive that someone with $20 in their wallet can't move their funds. Like, I had someone I know who had $20 in South Africa, $20 in their wallet, and they literally couldn't move the funds. They couldn't spend it. Like, how do you, like, so anyway, when Greg Maxwell and the guys are popping champagne because of $1,000 fees, it's $50 on average, but like some fees I saw was like $1,000 plus. I don't know what goes through these people's heads, to be quite frank.
I think it's the perennial debate going forward, and I can't believe it hasn't already been solved. But I guess in a way it kind of has, because the market broadly has just, whether it's discussed or the BTC impotence on that issue to make any real substantive change, people are searching for something like digital cash all over the place. So I've already taken up way too much of your time, and more than I actually had you agree to here. So just to be selfish, and for the listeners, you're notoriously contrarian. You are, of course, the Bitcoin Oracle. What do you think about this, just real quickly, this market? A lot of people are saying it's, you know, Bitcoin, the crypto winter is over. How do you see it going forward, at least in the near future?
Well, look, I'll say the crypto winter is over once we break 6,200. Okay, the overhead resistance from 5,500 to 6,200 is so heavy that only when we get past that can we actually say that it's over. So it's not over yet. We're still, you know, and I use that number as 2x off the bottom. 2x off the bottom is kind of when you're out of the winter season. We're not there.
I like that metric. It's easy.
And we're actually at the top of the channel that we're at right now, and we're hitting resistance in the channel the whole time. Like, if you say that the channel was 5,700 as the top, because that was the previous floor before it broke down below, and I called it breaking down below as well. I said it was going to break down at, you know, the 3,000 level,
right?
And I said it would go sideways for 3 to 6 months, and people laughed at me, and that's where we've been. So, you know, the one thing I definitely got wrong on Bitcoin is I did not expect Bitcoin's rise to 20,000, and I don't think anyone did, quite frankly, because it was not sustainable, clearly. And I said, like, there's no way people are going to be stupid enough to buy up all the way to 20,000. But guess what? You know, I can't be an oracle because I can't predict human stupidity.
Sure, so
I'm definitely not an oracle. But in terms of rational thought right now, I can't see us going to 6,300 anytime soon. The fundamentals aren't supported. You can argue as much as you want about institutional money coming in. When you see what's happening with the New York AG and Bitfinex, there's no institutional money coming in, I guarantee you. I'm a partner at Multicoin Capital. I'm a general partner, myself, Colin Tashar, and we have a good view of the market. And I think that it's very clear to us as a team that this is, you know, the institutional money isn't coming as people think it is, because we would know.
Right.
And if it does happen and we go to 6,300, I'm happy to say, okay, you know, market's turned, bear market, you know, the bottom's in, it's 3,100. Right now, I'm not even wanting to say that 3,100 is the bottom. I think we could possibly go lower. You know, it's, sentiment changes very quickly. Like, when you're at 5,500 or 5,300, no ways will we go below 3,100. No, it's never going to happen. If the price tanks down to 3,500, all of a sudden, actually, we could drop below 3,100. You know, so sentiment's always relative to where in the price curve you're sitting. And so what seems impossible today becomes possible tomorrow if you drop even 20 or 30%.
There it is. I can't say thank you enough for coming on. The wisdom in just this short amount of time has been really fun to listen to. Where can people find your work, find Civic, all the things that are going on that you're involved with?
So we have the Civic blog, I think civic.com/blog. You can find me on Twitter. You can find that's at Vinny Lingham. You can get the Civic account on Twitter as well. It's at Civic Key. I try and keep my Twitter feed updated with what I'm doing, what's going on. We're very focused on trying to figure out the identity layer for the world. And that's, like I said, that's what I focus my time and energy is on. So always happy to find people who want to, follow and work on that mission with us.
Very cool. Well, thanks again, man, for coming on. We really appreciate it. We'll have links to everything he's talked about in the show notes. And again, we are rooting for you. Thanks again, Vinny.
Thanks, Ed. Take care.